Good evening, everyone. So first, I want to thank Fishel for inviting me here tonight to share with you some words of Torah. I think we'd all agree that Fishel is a wonderful part of the fabric of our community, a real pillar of our community. And I'm sure that's a reflection of the avoda that both of his parents put into him. And we hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, that Reb Chaim Shmuel ben Rav Yitzchak Mordechai will enjoy an aliyah and a beautiful Gan Eden. Now, it's interesting that Tu Bishvat is not really one of the more celebrated, highly celebrated Yamim Tovim in our Judaic calendrical cycle. I think for most of us, if we have any childhood recollections of Tu Bishvat, it usually centers around a brown paper bag with some food items inside that resemble fruits, a little bit of buckser that maybe at one point in time was edible but clearly has long lost its edibility life, and a couple of other things sprinkled around. But the truth is, it doesn't really mean all that much to us. And it's interesting, I was remarking to someone, I don't think I've ever given a shiur on Tu Bishvat. And interestingly enough, this year I had to give two shiurim on Tu Bishvat. Thank God, one this morning for wit and one tonight. And I was told that there's going to be an overlap in the audiences, so I had to make two shiurim on Tu Bishvat. So we went from no shiurim to two shiurim for a Yom Tov that does not really have all that much excitement associated with it. But I think we all know enough to know that the beauty of our Torah is that there's so much profundity even in the things that look so ordinary. There's so much depth, there's so much meaning, even in those things that look so regular. So what I'd like to try to do tonight is to explore a little bit of the deeper meaning of Tu Bishvat. First, to analyze it a little bit from a halachic perspective, to understand why tonight, tomorrow, are halachically significant, significant from a Jewish law perspective, and then perhaps to explore a little bit of what we'll call the hashkafa, almost of the spiritual insights, the spiritual underpinnings of this significant day. So hopefully everyone has a sheet. Sheets around. Okay, I don't know if there are extras, but hopefully you're sitting next to someone who you like, if we don't have enough. So take a look at number one. The Mishnah Maseches Rosh Hashanah says, Arba'a Rosh Hashanim Heim. There are four new years. Be'echad B'Nisan Rosh Hashanah L'Melachim Regalim. The first of Nisan is Rosh Hashanah for kings and for regalim. Again, we're not really going to get into too much depth over here in terms of these other Rosh Hashanah, but essentially when counting the years of a monarch, the years, the cycle of the years of a monarchical reign begin from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Be'echad Be'elul Rosh Hashanah L'Maiser Behema, and again the first of Elul is the Rosh Hashanah for Maiser Behema, for tithing one's animals. Be'echad B'Tishrei Rosh Hashanah, Be'echad Tishrei Rosh Hashanah L'Shanim L'Shmitim L'Yovlos L'Netil Yirakos. The first of Tishrei, of course, is the first of the year for the calendrical perspective, for the years, for the Shemitah years. Remember, we operate in an agricultural cycle of 7 years. Those 7 years compose a unit of seven units of 7 years representing Shemitah. All of those years begin on the first of Tishrei. And finally, we come to the last line, Be'echad B'Shvat, on the first of Shvat, Rosh Hashanah Le'ilan, is the new year for the trees. Kedivrei Beis Shammai. This is the opinion of Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel on Beis Hillel says Bechamisha Asarba. So a fundamental dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel as to when the new year for the trees begin. According to Beis Shammai, it's on the first of Shvat. According to Beis Hillel, it's tonight, the 15th of Shvat. There's much to be said in terms of both the halacha and the hashkafa of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel's debate. But for tonight, we're just going to focus exclusively on the opinion of Beis Hillel, focusing on Tu Bishvat, the 15th of Shvat, as the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilonos. And the obvious question then comes up, what does it mean to have a new year for fruit? What does that mean? What's the ramification of that? And if you look at number two, the Bartanuri explains Rosh Hashanah Le'ilon, Le'inyon Ma'aser Peros. The ramification of this is for how you tithe your fruits. So just to understand a little bit of a background in terms of Trumos and Maisros, we know that in agricultural society, one has an obligation to separate out various tithes. Remember, Shevet Levi, which for us represents the Kohanim and the Levim, devote themselves exclusively to Avodah, to service in the Beis HaMikdash, and as such, their source of support must come from the general populace. That support is comprised of Trumos and Maisros, various tithes. So for example, we know we separate Truma, Truma is the portion that goes to the Kohen. We have Meiser, which is 1/10 of the remaining amount that then goes to the Levi. And then there's an additional 1/10 that's separated. The identity of that 1/10 depends on the year of the agricultural cycle. So on years 1, 2, 4, and 5 of the Shemitah year cycle, that 1/10 is designated as Meiser Sheni. Meiser Sheni, who gets to eat Meiser Sheni? The owner of the produce gets to eat Meiser Sheni. With one caveat, he must take it to Yerushalayim. It must be consumed within Jerusalem. So it's yours, but you have to consume it in Yerushalayim. And in years 3 and 6 of the 7-year Shemitah cycle, that additional 1/10 becomes what's called Meiser Ani, an additional tithe for the poor. So on the most basic level, explains the Bartanura, we have a concept when it comes to tithing that you can't tithe 1 year's produce from another year's produce, meaning you must tithe each crop from the very year in which it matured, from the very year in which it came into this world. Therefore, because you can't tithe from 1 year on to the next, it's very important to know what? When the year begins and when the year ends. So explains the Bartanura, Beis Hillel says the 15th of Shvat is the new year for trees, the new year for fruits of the tree, which means that between the 1st of Shvat this year and the end of Teves next year represents 1 year in the agricultural cycle. And when you tithe your fruit, you may only take tithes from fruits that came into being between this year, 15th of Shvat, and next year, and the coming year, the end of Teves. Why Shvat? Why does all this occur in the month of Shvat? So if you look at number 3, the Gemara explains, Be'echot b'shvat Rosh Hashanah le'ilan. Now, what's bothering the Gemara is what? Why does the Gemara ask, my time, or what's the reason for Shvat? Because the truth is, if you look outside, you know, I mentioned this morning that one of the starkest reminders that we are in Galus is agriculturally based observances. Because remember, again, we're in the middle of winter. We're in the middle of winter. Now, Eretz Yisrael also still has more winter to come. But as we'll see in just a little bit, already the process of blossoming begins in Eretz Yisrael already this time. But the Gemara says, but still, when you go outside, for the most part, you're not going to see the fruit trees coming alive even in Eretz Yisrael on Tu B'Shvat. So why do we mark this new year for fruit on this day? My taima, Am Rebbe Elazar, Am Rebbe Hoshea, Afa Pi Sherov Tekufa Mibachutz, Hoil V'yotzu Rov Gishmei Hashana. So the Gemara explains, because by the time Tu B'Shvat comes along, what's happened already? Most of the rainfall for the year has already fallen. So the majority of rain, the majority of the seasonal rains have already fallen by this point in time. Why is this important? Because Rashi explains in number 4, Hoil V'yotzu Rov Gishmei Hashana, Shekvar Avar Rov Yemos HaGishamim, Shuzman Revia V'ala Hasraf Be'ilonos. Rashi explains, because most of the rains have already fallen, therefore what? The sap is already rising in the tree. Meaning, because most of the nutrients have been received already, the sap is already begin to rise in the tree, and therefore again, tree life is already beginning to take root. Even though most of this life is being expressed internally, inside the tree, but the fact that we know this is happening means it's the beginning already of the blossoming season. V'nimtzu haperos chontin me'ata. And the fruit begin to bloom, begin to blossom already from this point in time. So here we have essentially the halacha concerning Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat, on a very technical level, is really important vis-a-vis tithing. This is the new year for the trees, which just tells me that in order to be able to tithe fruits, I have to tithe them from 15th of Shvat until, again, we'll call it the 14th of Shvat in the coming year. Anything that grows in this year must be tithed from that very same crop. Okay, interesting. Not exceptionally riveting, but nevertheless, agriculturally important. Comes on the Shulchan Aruch number 5 and says the following. Nagu shelo lipol al peneim b'tu b'shvat. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't really talk all that much about Tu B'Shvat. It's actually, this section, this simen, is not the halachos of Tu B'Shvat. There's no simen that talks about halachos Tu B'Shvat. This simen talks about the laws of Tachanun. Remember, again, immediately after Shemona Esrei, there's a tefillah called Tachanun. So Tachanun, we know, is a supplicatory prayer. Vayomer David al God, sarli ma'od. It's a tefillah that speaks about existential distress. It's a tefillah that speaks about difficulty, a tefillah that talks about suffering, a tefillah that says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please redeem me from the difficult straits of the human condition. So the Shulchan Aruch says that on Tu B'Shvat, we don't go ahead and say Tachanun. Okay, so if you look At number six, the Mishnah Berurah explains why is that. But Tu B'Shvat, Shu Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos. So he explains because, again, Tu B'Shvat is the new year for trees. V'Noagin Ha'ashkenazim. Okay, fine. So the fact that we don't say Tachanun, so for many, again, anytime you don't say Tachanun is a major yontif, right? Especially, again, when it falls out on a Thursday, Mamish. But again, what's interesting about this is the following. What does it mean if I don't say Tachanun? Meaning, what's the practical ramification? What does that tell me about the identity of the day? So interestingly enough, if you look in the Sefer Shiboli Aleket, the Shiboli Aleket brings down in his section on Tefillah the following idea. Shiboli Aleket writes, B'rosh Chodesh ein noflin al pneihem, da'ashkechan di'ikri moed. So the Shiboli Aleket writes, totally unrelated to Tu B'Shvat, but writes again that on Rosh Chodesh, we also don't recite Tachanun. Why not? Why not? Because Rosh Chodesh is called a moed. Rosh Chodesh is called a day of celebration. And therefore, if it's a day of celebration, we don't say Tachanun. Therefore, one can make the argument that any day that we don't say Tachanun must by definition be considered what? A moed. A Yom Tov. So therefore, already we see the halacha hinting to us, again, not directly, but indirectly, that through the omission of Tachanun, through the omission of this supplicatory prayer that speaks about the existential distress of man, the fact that we omit this on Tu B'Shvat indicates to us that Tu B'Shvat is also a quasi-Yom Tov. And in fact, another proof to that is if you look in number 8, so the Shulchan Aruch says in the laws of communal fast days, the Shulchan Aruch writes, Sibor Shebikshu, Ligzor Tanis Sheni Vechamishi Vesheni. If you had a community that wanted to institute a series of successive fasts on a Monday, a Thursday, and a Monday again, Upaga Betanis Betu B'Shvat. And let's say one of those dates happens to coincide with Tu B'Shvat. What's the halacha? Hatanis Nitcha L'Shabbos Haba. We do not fast on Tu B'Shvat. Kedei Shelo Yigzeru Tanis Betu B'Shvat Shurosh Hashana Le'ilanos. So again, the Shulchan Aruch makes an amazing statement. So again, even if there's a series of communal fast days, if one of those fast days falls out on Tu B'Shvat, we push it off. So now you see, in two different areas in halacha, A, we're omitting Tachanun. B, even if a communal fast day falls on this date, we will defer that communal fast day to a later date. Clearly, everything is pointing in one direction, which is that Tu B'Shvat is some kind of Yom Tov. That Tu B'Shvat has some type of at least quasi-moed, quasi-celebration associated with it. Which then leads us to the obvious question, which is, at least the people from the regular Wednesday night share, I expect to answer these questions. Right? It leads us to the obvious question, which is why? Why? Meaning, again, I showed you, I'm not holding anything back. I showed you in source number 1, source number 2, source number 3, the halachos concerning Tu B'Shvat. Again, very interesting from an agricultural perspective, but certainly nothing that we would associate with Yom Tov-like identity. But yet again, we're omitting Tachanun. We are not going to fast on this day. So the obvious question is, what is the Yom Tov nature of Tu B'Shvat? So if you look at number 9, the Mordechai, and I include a few, a little bit of a biography, some of the people we're quoting today, because it's important to know whose Torah it is that you're learning. So the Mordechai writes in his commentary in the back of Maseches Rosh Hashanah, he says, he actually addresses the question raised in the Shulchan Aruch in number 8. He speaks about fasting on Tu B'Shvat. And he says, we don't fast on Tu B'Shvat. And he says, why not? Why not? He gives a very interesting answer. He says, because if you look back in number 1, the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah talks about the 4 Rosh Hashanahs, the 4 new years. And the Gemara equates all of them. The Gemara groups them together. And so the Mordechai says, are we permitted to go ahead and fast on Rosh Hashanah? I say Rosh Hashanah, I mean the first of Tishrei. Are you permitted to fast on Rosh Hashanah? So the truth is, it happens to be it's a machlokes. It's an interesting dispute in halacha. But again, we pass out, we don't fast on Rosh Hashanah. So the Mordechai says, essentially, because all of these days are grouped together, they share similar characteristics. So just like there's no tachanun on Rosh Hashanah, just like there's no fasting on Rosh Hashanah, so too that same concept will apply to all of the other new years mentioned in the Mishnah. So a very interesting answer, but again, doesn't address the core of our issue. So the Mordechai just simply says the fact that everything is mentioned together in the Mishnah is enough to say that they share common qualities, no tachanun, no fasting, but doesn't get into the why. So the fundamental question, Thank you. The fundamental question then becomes, we're going to try to explore for our remaining time tonight, is why? What is the nature of the Simcha of Tu Bishvat? What is the nature of the Yom Tov identity of this day? What is the nature of the Moed of Tu Bishvat? So I want to share with you two different approaches. The first is a beautiful approach by Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe, number 10, at the end of Rav Moshe's insights into the Parsha, Drash Moshe, at the end of Parshas Bishalach, he has a small section about Tu Bishvat. And in this section, Rav Moshe asks, if you look at 10a, he always says over here, Parshas Bishalach, Tu Bishvat amarti tam al hasimcha be'etzem, v'shagam ato anu smichem barashana le'ilonos, asheru shayach rak l'dinei meiser, she'in ma'asrin shana al chaverta. So Rav Moshe asks, we ask Rav Moshe's question, which is, why is there simcha associated with this day? It's agriculturally significant, but doesn't seem to have all that much meaning otherwise. And Rav Moshe says something beautiful. He says, she'ine yadua, she'shevet levi lo natal nachala, v'cho yiso laku nachalasam. So Rav Moshe here advances a beautiful insight. Rav Moshe explains that we know that Shevet Levi did not get a portion in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Moshe says, so what happened to Shevet Levi's portion? Tribe of Levi doesn't get a tribal portion of the land of Israel. So what happened to Shevet Levi's portion? What happened to it? It was divided among the other tribes. Everyone else got the portion, or a piece of the portion, that should have been Shevet Levi's. And Rav Moshe writes, he says, V'im kein, Be'etzem ha-ma'asros shenostim lahen, eina tova meha Yisrael be'etzem, elachov kischirus. Rav Moshe advances such a beautiful insight. Rav Moshe says, we give tithes, we give trumos and maestros to Shevet Levi, to Kohanim and Levim. And he says, often we assume that those tithes are like gifts. Rav Moshe says, they're not gifts. You know what they are? They're rental payments. Meaning what? Shevet Levi was supposed to get land. We took their land. We're living on their land. We're enjoying their land. And therefore, what do we do every single year? What do? We pay them for their land. We pay them a usage fee for their land. And says Rav Moshe, you know what the amazing part is? Until you pay the usage fee, the land is not yours. Until you pay the usage fee, you do not take appropriate halachic title over the object. Rav Moshe says people think that shumos and maestros are a nice favor. It's a nice tzedakah. It's a nice charity that you give to the Kohanim and Levim. Rav Moshe says it's absolutely obligatory, no different than if you are renting a field from anyone else that you have to pay the rental fee, and you only get true title to the land after you pay your fee. So says Rav Moshe, if you skip down to the end of paragraph B, Rav Moshe says, v'zeu, and again, remember, when do you have to pay that fee? You have to pay that fee within the year. You have to pay the same time, the same year in which the crop matures. That is the same year in which you must tithe, in which you must give your trumos and maestros, in which you must give your rental fee. So he says, v'zeu atam, last four lines in paragraph B, number 10. V'zeu atam, diyesh Rosh Hashanah l'din maestros, ubi'ilanos hu yom tu bishvat, shu simcha gidola, Shebazeh naaseh hates chalokim shalom mamish. Rav Moshe says so beautifully, everyone focuses on Tu Bishvat as the beginning of the new tithing year. But you know what else Tu Bishvat represents? Tu Bishvat also represents what? The end of the previous year. Which means that what were people probably doing in the days leading up to Tu Bishvat? And Yud Aleph, and Yud Beis, and Yud Gimel, what were they doing? What were they doing? They were paying out their trumos and maestros. They were paying out their tithes because the year is coming to a close. But you know what's amazing? When they went ahead and they paid out their tithes, that's ultimately when they took real possession of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu had given them. Rav Moshe says, that's the simcha. That's the joy of Tu Bishvat. You see, sometimes we think that when it comes to our materialism, it's ours. It belongs to me. I worked for it. I earned it, hopefully, honestly. I worked very hard for it. I put in the effort for it, magiali, and now it's mine. Rav Moshe says, the only time you own your material wealth is when you use it to benefit others. When you take what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given you, and you use it to build up another, and you use it to support another, and you use it to help another, when you take what you have and you use it to go ahead and support someone else, says Rav Moshe, that's when you own your materialism. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us material things in this world. Some have, some don't. Those who have are supposed to be the custodians, the caretakers for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wealth, to ultimately distribute it to others. Says Rav Moshe, on Tu B'Shvat, this was the day where by this time everybody had to give out their trumos and maestros. And it was at this day that everyone finally took title to their material possessions. Because the only time that you truly own your material possessions is after you have used it to help another. The Simcha of Tu B'Shvat is that I could sit down and I could say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you gave me physical bounty, you gave me physical blessing, and I understand that in order to own it, I have to give it. In order to own it, I have to share it. In order to take physical title, I have to distribute it first to the others who are in need. Says Rav Moshe, that's the Simcha of Tu B'Shvat. That's the beautiful happiness of this day. On this day, I own my material possessions, my wealth, my income, because by this day, I have hopefully taken care of all of my tithing responsibilities and used my material wealth, my material bounty, to help, to aid, to build up, and to bolster the other. It's Rav Moshe's approach. But I want to share with you one more approach. Sometimes in order to discover the deeper meaning of something, a person has to go back to the first time something occurs in the Torah. So if we want to go ahead and understand what this Rosh Hashanah Le'ilanos, what this new year for the trees is really all about, I think it behooves us to go back to the first time that the trees make an appearance on the biblical scene. And if you take a look at number 11, the Torah tells us in Bereishis, Vayomer Elokim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Tad she ha'aretz desha, mazriya zera. Let the earth bring forth, let the earth sprout vegetation. Isa mazriya zera, sealed seed-yielding herbs. Eitz pri oseh peri, fruit trees that produce fruit, let me know, according to its kind. Asher zaro bo, ala aretz vayichein. Okay. Vatotze ha'aretz desha, Esav Mazriya Zer Limineo. So what happens? The earth gives forth vegetation, seed-yielding herbs according to its kind. The eitz oseperi, and trees that produce fruit. Asher Zaro Bo Limineo, in which its seed is found according to its kind. Vayar Elokim Kitov. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that it was good. The Medrash, Rashi quotes this Medrash as well. The Medrash number 12 picks up on a textual anomaly. What's the anomaly? That ultimately would appear that what God wanted to happen did not happen. What did HaKadosh Baruch Hu charge the earth with doing? Eitz pri oseh peri, a fruit tree that produces fruit. And what did the earth produce? Eitz, a tree, oseh peri. And the Medrash says, what's going on over here? Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon Omar, she'avra alatzivui. The earth disobeyed God. Shekach Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what did God say? Tad she ha'aretz, eitz peri, mahapri ne'echal, af ha'eitz yehe ne'echal. Says the Medrash so profoundly. When God says, remember, there are no extra words in the Torah. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have just said, like it says actually in Pasuk Yud Beis, eitz oseh peri. Why does God say eitz pri oseh peri? Why a fruit tree that produces fruit? To what purpose? Because what did God want? God wanted something amazing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted fruit that tastes like fruit. And what else did he want? He wanted trees that tasted like fruit as well. That's eitz pri oseh peri. A fruit tree, i.e. a tree that tastes like fruit, that produces fruit that tastes like fruit. But says the Medrash, the earth did not comply. Instead, what happened? V'hi lo asa came. The earth did not comply. Ela vatotze ha'aretz desha, esev mazriya, hapri ne'echal, ve'ein ha'etz ne'echal. So the Medrash says, the earth did not comply, and instead what did the earth produce? The earth produced a tree and fruit. So the fruit tastes like fruit, and the tree tastes like a tree. So the earth did not comply with the Ribono Shel Olam. So obviously, we know already over here that the Medrash is expressing to us something much deeper. Why? Because you know that the only thing in this entire universe that has Bechira Chavshis, that has free will, is man. And as such, again, the earth cannot defy the Ribono Shel Olam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the earth that it has to do something, the natural universe always has to respond to the will and to the whim of the divine. So clearly, the earth can't literally disobey. So what's happening over here? If you look at number 13, the Maharal in his Perish Gur Aryeh says something that I think is astounding. The Maharal writes, he says, V'hilo asakein, eina perish. Paragraph A. Ema perush shadama avra b'meizal tzivay Hakadosh Baruch Hu. It can't literally mean that the earth actively defied Hakadosh Baruch Hu's desire, Hakadosh Baruch Hu's command. She'ein yetzer haraba shetehei overes al tzivay Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Because the earth, it's interesting, the Maharal understands that the ability or the willingness to transgress the word of God is a function of a yetzer hara, is a function of an evil inclination. So obviously, again, inanimate objects do not have evil inclinations. Man is the only thing that has yetzer hara. So therefore, the Maharal says it can't literally mean that the earth is defying God. So what happens? Listen to what the Maharal says. Aval ki ha'aretz hazos shinui yeshla. The Maharal says, the earth, it possesses this shinui. It possesses this notion of change. Shehi bilvan nechshevas mina tachtonim. Ki ha-shamayim shamayim la-Hashem, v'ya'aretz nasan livnei adam. What does this mean? Yore bazeh, ki shinui yesh bein ha'aretz u bein ha-shamayim. So the Maharal says, when David HaMelech says in Tehillim that the heavens are for God and the earth is for man, what King David was saying is, there's a fundamental difference between heaven and earth. So you'll say to yourself, obviously there's a fundamental difference between heaven and earth. What's the chiddush? What's the novelty there? He says, ki ha-shamayim hein min ha'alyonim. The celestial sphere is above, v'ha'aretz min ha'tachtonim. The earth is below. U'ba'avor chesrona, hi mechaseres min ha'shleimus tamid. So the Maharal says something amazing. The Maharal essentially explains that the earth is inherently deficient and imperfect. Anything outside of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there's only one place in which perfection, completion is to be found in this universe, and that's where? That's in the celestial sphere by God. Anything else outside of God, by definition, is imperfect, and is incomplete, is deficient. In fact, if you take a quick look in paragraph C, the footnote there, footnote 111, he says, "Shi'i efshar, she'yihye nimtza ha'briya b'shleimus gamur, Rak yesh bo chisaron. It is impossible for creation to be complete. Why? Because there is no completion outside of God. Velirmos zeh kasav bereishis. Look what he says. This is according from the Maharal as well. What does the Maharal say? How does the Torah begin? Bereishis bar elokim es hashamayim v'haaretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. V'haaretz haisa tohu vavohu. What does the earth look like in the beginning? What does it look like? What does tohu vavohu mean? Formless, you know how they translate it often is astonishingly empty. Not just a little empty, not just a shekel empty, astonishingly empty. So the Maharal says, isn't that interesting? That the way that the Torah begins is v'ha'aretz haisa tov vavod. The Maharal says, the Torah is giving us a very important principle. There's no completion, there's no perfection to be found in this world. This world is inherently flawed. This world is inherently deficient. This world is inherently imperfect. Va'aretz haisa tov vavo. Ki ha'aretz si b'tachtonim l'kach haisa tov vavo. V'choshech al pnei tov. Go back to the Maharal in paragraph A. He says, v'zeu sha'amar. What is that? Shlomo HaMelech writes in Koheles. Ein adam tzadik ba'aretz asher ya'aseh tov v'lo yechta. That's why Shlomo HaMelech writes, there's no such thing as a righteous person who doesn't sin. No such thing. Now, how can you say that? Because again, by definition, sin is imperfection. Sin is incompletion. And if you live in this world, one thing is for sure, and it's not just death and taxes. What else is it? It's that you're going to fail. You're going to fail. No matter how hard you try, at some point in time, you are going to fail. In fact, in life we actually don't try to avoid failure. Because avoidance of failure is an exercise in futility. What we try to avoid is failing over and over in the same way. We try to learn from our mistakes with a full recognition that even if we conquer our failures in one area, we will inevitably fail in other areas of life. Again, not because we're bad, not because we don't care, but because that's the nature of the human condition in the imperfect, efficient world. He goes on, Marali says, Pirish, ki e'efshar lios ha'adam tzadik ba'aretz, asher ya'aseh tamir atov ha'shalimus ba'aretz, shimuchenes tamir, that's Shlomo HaMelech writes, ein adam tzadik ba'aretz. It is impossible to be completely righteous when? Ba'aretz. When you occupy the deficient, imperfect earth. Lekach, paragraph B. Ka'asher gozer ma'amar ha'kodosh, eitz prio sepri, ba'avor chesrona, lo haysa memalis ratzon bora, v'haysa mechaseres minashleimus. So the Maharal says something absolutely amazing. The Maharal says, you know what's happening over here right in front of us in the text? Obviously, the earth can't defy God. Which means that although God gives the command for the earth to produce eitz prio sepri, to produce fruit trees that taste like fruit and fruit that tastes like fruit, it's clearly God that chose not to actualize that mandate. Why, says the Maharal? What HaKadosh Baruch Hu is asking when he says, earth, I want you to bring forth eitz prio sepri. I want you to bring forth fruit trees that taste like fruit. What was God trying to create? What was he trying to, why? Why do you need fruit trees that taste like fruit? What is God trying to do? The Maharal says, he was trying to create perfection. Imagine if the fruit trees tasted like fruit as well. Natural equilibrium, natural harmony, everything is good, everything is sweet, everything is perfect. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu begins to create the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu begins with a machshava, with a divine mindset of perfection. But then when it comes time, tachlis, to actually create, what does God create? God creates eitz osa pri. The fruit tree does not taste like fruit. The fruit tree tastes like a tree. The fruit tastes like fruit. Maybe in the celestial sphere, the trees could be sweet as well. But here in this world, this is the world of imperfection. This is the world of incompletion. This is the world of deficiency. And as such, says the Maharal, the tree is the paradigmatic representation of the inherent imperfections in this world. The tree represents the fact that although there is so much good in this world, so much tov, the world, this world, ha'aretz, by definition is deficient, by definition is lacking, by definition is imperfect. The tree is the ultimate paradigmatic representation of this phenomenon. But there's something else. Take a look at number 14. In addition to the tasteless tree representing inherent imperfection in this world, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook says something amazing in his Oros HaTshuva. Now I have to tell you just a word about Rav Kook's Oros HaTshuva. If you've ever tried learning Rav Kook's works, Rav Kook is very difficult. His works are very difficult to learn. Part of it has to do with the wording, the verbiage that he uses, and he tries to express very esoteric concepts. So you have to know something about Rav Kook. If you ever had the chance to visit Beit Harav, Rav Kook's house in Yerushalayim, they have some of his manuscripts on display. And what's amazing is that Rav Kook never erased. Can you imagine that? Rav Kook never had to correct a thought. What he wrote on paper was already his finished product. In all of his handwritings, in all of his kisveyad, there are no erasures. There's no draft copies. There's nothing new. Rav Kook, from his mind, he distilled it in his mind and he put it down on paper. Rav Kook wrote Oros HaTshuva without svarim. He sat down with a pad, and he wrote Oros HaTshuva. Oros HaTshuva, as you can imagine, is all about the processes of tshuva, of repentance. And Rav Kook wrote it. So it's not, if you're a person who enjoys, you know, very, I guess, we'll call it, you know, classical Litvisha anthology, this won't satisfy you, because Rav Kook often doesn't quote sources. Rav Kook often goes in many different directions, but it's amazing to see Rav Kook's free flow of consciousness. What Rav Kook writes over number 14, this is in the 16th chapter in Oros HaTshuva. He says, "Machashake ha'avaya alufim heim bepacha de'ashav." Those who live in the darkness of the present often live enveloped in fear, but fear of nothing. Shema'afayem mispashtim b'nishamos hayochid v'atzibar b'nefesham m'kusher b'tnei alachatz v'chukim me'ikim al chufshas amitis. Skip to the next line. She says, Bal tshuva mefachet. If somebody's about tshuva, somebody wants to tshuva, turn their life around, they get scared. Why do they get scared? Sha'avonosav kvar ibduhu v'shetikvaso kvar afsa. What is the Baal Tshuva scared about? The Baal Tshuva scared about that, you know what? Maybe I'm too far gone. Maybe ultimately I have too many sins. Maybe I'm too broken. Maybe I'm too tarnished. I'm too sullied. I lived my life in a certain way over these years, and maybe there's just simply no hope for me. I am beyond salvation and redemption. The Einenu Yodea, and Rav Kook says, but the Baal Tshuva doesn't realize, Shebesoch Pachdo, within his fear, Kvar kol orotz hasaloso minuchim heim bignizasam. Rav Kook says, you know what the irony is? The irony is that within those very cries of despair, within those feelings of yeush, of giving up, within that pachad, within that fear itself, says Rav Kook, is the light of his salvation are buried within. Okay? He goes on. Listen to this line. Pachad ha'aretz. The earth was also scared. Gam kein. The earth was also scared. And because the earth was scared, it did not bring forth Eitz Pri Oseh Pri. The earth was supposed to bring forth not just fruit trees, but it was supposed to bring forth again fruit trees, trees that tasted like fruit and fruit that tasted like fruit. And why didn't do it? Says Rav Kook, because the earth was scared. Sheetamo kitam pirio. The moon was scared, and he goes on. He explains, people are scared. So what is Rav Kook explaining over here? The earth was scared, and therefore it did not go ahead and bring forth the fruit. I think what Rav Kook is trying to highlight over here is the following. What was the earth? And obviously, Rav Kook is writing on a metaphorical level because the whole discussion is metaphorical. But what does it mean that the earth was scared? What was God asking for from the earth? What God was asking for was perfection. But the earth said, I'm scared to comply with the divine decree. Because you know what happens? You see, Rav Kook argues with the Maharal. The Maharal says that the earth could have never been perfect because perfection is not to be found in this world. Rav Kook says, no, the earth could have been perfect. It could have been, maybe not celestial perfection, but it could have achieved some level of earthly perfection. So why didn't it? Why didn't it? Says Rav Kook, because the earth was scared. Namely, that the earth understood that if it would comply with the desires for divine perfection, then it would show itself and it would show HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it has the ability to be perfect. And what happens once you show yourself and your God that you have the ability to be perfect? What happens? The expectations go through the roof. You see, my friends, if we're honest with ourselves, many of us deep down prefer mediocrity. Many of us just prefer to be ordinary. We convince ourselves that we're ordinary because the truth is, it's much easier to live life. If I am just mediocre, if I'm just a regular person, then you know what? There are no major expectations. I don't really have to accomplish anything that great. I just simply have to get by. Because if I show myself, if I show my God that I can be, so to speak, earthly perfect, if I show my God that I could do something spectacular, then suddenly the expectations that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has of me, the expectations that I have to have of myself, dramatically change. And I don't know if I want that, because I may have to change certain things about my life. I may have to change certain things about my lifestyle. I may have to change certain things about my identity, about my personality. And the truth is, I'm not ready to make those changes. Those are major, major changes, so I'll make you a better deal. I'll just be mediocre. I'll just be regular. And that way, truth is, everyone's just going to leave me alone. Because as long as I'm okay, as long as I get by, as long as I don't make too many waves, I could just simply coast through life. Says Rav Kook, the earth did not comply with the will of God because the earth was concerned. The earth was concerned that if I come through now, what is God going to want me to do next? If I could produce fruit trees that taste like fruit, then what are the divine expectations going forward? Rav Kook says, the Baal Tshuva likes to tell him or herself that what? That I'm beyond salvation. Says Rav Kook, why do they do that? Why? People do this all the time. People, I know what I have to change. I know what I have to adjust. I know what I have to tweak in my life, but I don't do it. Why don't I do it? Because, so the excuse I give is because I'm too far gone. I am who I am. This is who I've lived. But the truth is, why really don't I do it? Says Rav Kook, because I'm scared. Because if I make those changes that I need to make, if I tweak those parts of my persona that I know I need to tweak, then suddenly I show myself that I can be better. Then suddenly I show my God that I'm not ordinary. And the moment that that occurs is the moment that the expectations that life has for me grow exponentially. And that's scary. It's scary to think that I can be more. It's scary to think that I can be great. It's scary to think that I can be complete. It's scary to think that I can be magnificent. And therefore, most of us succumb to our fear and just simply lead ordinary, mediocre lives. And says Rav Kook, this ultimately is what the tree represents. The tree represents such beautiful potential that has failed to actualize simply because of fear. Potential that has failed to actualize because I'm nervous that if I do this, then I'm going to have to push myself a little bit further and do something else. So what comes out, according to the Maharal and according to Rav Kook, is that the tree represents two very different things. According to the Maharal, what does the tree represent? Imperfection. I don't want to have to start again. Right? So again, according to the Maharal, what does the tree represent? Imperfection. The tree represents earthly imperfection. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Eitz Pri Yoseh Pri. God wanted perfection. God wanted universal equilibrium. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted harmony between the celestial sphere and the earthly domain. No, no, no. Doesn't happen. It's program. Again, it doesn't happen because God didn't want it to happen. Remember, this is by design. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I once heard a wonderful quote, that God created an imperfect world perfectly. Remember, the imperfections are by design. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not want perfection here we'll save that for a different year. But according to the Maharal, the tree is the paradigm of earthly imperfection and earthly deficiency. According to Rav Kook says the tree represents boundless potential that is handicapped by fear. Boundless potential that is held in check because it's too afraid to actualize, because if it actualizes in this way, it may be called upon to actualize in other ways. And now we come to Tu Bishvat. If you look at number 15, the Torah says, at the end of Parshas Kisetze, again, without getting into the entire text of the Pasuk, the topic over here is laying siege to a city. And the Torah speaks about the fact that when you're laying siege to a city, you may not needlessly destroy fruit trees. The concept that becomes globalized as Baal Tashlis. You can't engage in needless wanton destruction for no reason. And the Torah says, if you look at the underlying phrase, which is the only phrase we're going to focus on in this pasuk, ki ha'odom eitz hasodeh, because man is like the tree. Man is like the tree. And there are many times throughout Tanakh that man is compared to a tree. David HaMelech says it in Tehillim, v'haya ke'eitz shasul al pal geimayim. Man is like a tree that is planted by the river. Many times throughout Tanakh, ki ha'odom eitz hasodeh. Out of all the things that you could have compared man to, why a tree? So again, I think the classic understanding is because man has roots. Remember, we don't exist by ourselves. We come somewhere. But then again, it's not just to have roots. You also have to sprout branches and leaves and fruit. You have to have future generations. But I think the Torah is telling us something much more profound. The Torah is telling us, what does it mean, ki ha'odom eitz hasodeh? What does the tree represent? We just saw, according to the Maharal and Rav Kook, what the tree represents. The tree represents, again, deficiency, imperfection. The tree is the paradigm of imperfection. The tree ultimately represents this potential that is stymied and handicapped by fear. And I think what the Torah is telling us is the following. When I look at the tree, kiviyachol, it's like looking into a mirror. Because the truth is, when I see the tree, I know about myself that I'm imperfect. And I'm frustrated by my imperfection. I'm frustrated by it. Because there are so many times that I try to remedy the imperfection. There are so many times that I try to do things differently. How many times do we know what we have to correct in life? And we make a really good effort at it. And we sustain it for a little while. And then what happens? Baruch Hashem, no one here knows. Then what happens? I've heard from other people. What happens? We fall. And we fall in the same exact way. And I wondered to myself, how did this happen? I tried so hard. I put in so much effort. I changed certain things. And we look back at our life and we wonder, why can't I move myself forward? Granted, we do accomplish many things. But I'm frustrated because the thinking person lives in a constant state of imperfection. If you are the person who you want to be, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, then you're setting the bar very low. If you feel that you're fully self-actualized, then you're really taking it way too easy on yourself. I give you the bracha, you should never be the person you want to be. You should always be working towards something, but herein lies the greatest difficulty in life. I keep trying, and no matter how much I try, I'm not there. No matter how much I sprint, it seems to be that God moves the finish line a little bit further back. No matter how much I try to grow, how much I try to change, how much I try to adapt, I'm always struggling. Kia, other means I am the tree. I am the tree. You know what I want more than anything? I want to be Eitz Priyosepri. I would give anything to be a tree that tastes like fruit and produce fruit. I would do anything to get to that level where I feel my life is in harmony. But it's not to be. At most I can be is an Eitz Oseperi. The most I can be is a tree that produces some fruit, but is deficient as well. Ki Adam Eitz Asoda. I am that tree always struggling with my imperfection. I am the tree, says Rav Kook. Ultimately, we all know, because the truth is, it's part of the fabric of the human condition. There are opportunities that we've missed. Opportunities that we've passed up. Beautiful doors that we failed to open. Why? Why? So the truth is, we generally have very good excuses for it. It's not, and the number one is usually it's not the right time. Not the right time. Not right now. When's the right time? I don't know, but I'll let you know when it comes. Right? But it's not the right time. I'll get there. And we miss up, and when you get into the habit of passing up on opportunities, you become ragil, you become murgo, you become regular in that. And so often we fail to self-actualize. We fail to make the changes we need to do. We fail to become the people we know we need to be, and for no good reason other than we're scared. Because if I move my life forward in one area, it means that I have the ability to move my life forward in the other areas as well. And that's what we call a mechayiv. That's something that becomes, that obligates me to be something more, to be something better, and that's scary. So I'd rather just be the regular tree. I'd rather just be the Eitz Priyosepri. I'd rather just be mediocre, and everyone leave me alone. I'll go about my business. I'll do what I have to do to get by, but don't expect anything spectacular from me. Kia Adam Eitz Hasada. But you want to hear something amazing? Because both what Rav Kook and the Maharal have in common is that God created a world that's imperfect. And he created this imperfect world purposely. Why? Take a look at number 16. Rav Moshe Chaim Litzata, the Ramchal, writes in Derech Hashem the following. He says, Va'al kein gozer v'sidir sheyivru inyonei shleimus v'inyonei chisarom. God had in this world that there are certain things that are complete and certain things that are incomplete. V'tivra b'riya shiyeh b'ha'efsharus l'shnei ha'inyonim. And God created a creation. We'll call that creation man, who has the ability to engage in that which is complete and that which is incomplete. And what happens? V'yitnu l'briya emtsoim sha'al yodam tikna la'atzmo es ha'shlimus. The Ramchal says something amazing. Do you know why God created an imperfect world? Do you know God could have created Eitz Priyosepri? So why does he just create Eitz Oseperi? You know why? Because he wants us to fix this world. Because he wants us to do something significant. Because he wants us to take all of the imperfections that we see within ourselves and that we see within the greater world, and he wants us to do something about it. He doesn't want us just to simply lament. You know, when a person sees either him or herself or the world in a state of imperfection, there are two approaches. You could either say, oi, it's so terrible, everything is so terrible, it's such a state of disarray, and you'll use up all of your emotional energy, and what will you get done? Absolutely nothing. Or you can say, you know what, yes, I am imperfect, my life is imperfect, my world that I live in is imperfect, and so how do I infuse a little more perfection into an imperfect world? How do I bring a little bit of shlemus, a little bit of completion into a world that is so broken? How do I improve myself knowing that I am so incredibly deficient? And Rav Kook says along the same lines in number 17, in Oros HaKodesh, Rav Kook writes, Bozeh Quick is a beautiful verbiage here. Bazeh ya'aseh hanivra es atzmo. We have the ability to make ourselves. V'yihye b'madregas hashlemos shalabore. V'yis'ala mima'al ligvul shal nivra. Rav Kook says so beautifully that we often view ourselves as creators. Excuse me. We view ourselves as creations. But Rav Kook says, you know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did? HaKadosh Baruch Hu created an imperfect world for one purpose. See, if God created a perfect world, then all I could ever be is a creation. When God created an imperfect world, you know what He gave me the ability to do? A beautiful gift. He gave me the ability to become a creator. He gave me the ability not just to be a nivra, not just to be a creation, but to be a bore. And how do I become a bore? By tackling and trying to remedy the deficiencies, the things that lack, the voids that exist, the imperfections. When I address them internally and externally, I transform myself from simply being a creation, a nivra, to ultimately being a bore. You could spend your life lamenting the state of disrepair in this world, or you could find the courage to do something about it. God created an imperfect world perfectly to give us the greatest opportunity to partner with Him in the creative process. And so yes, Kia Adam Eitz Asad, that I am a deficient tree. I am. I'm just an Eitz Oseh Peri. I wish I was an Eitz Peri, but I'm not. I'm just a regular Eitz. I know I can be great, but I'm so scared of doing what I have to do because then everyone, including God, is going to expect so much of me. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, go for it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you may never become an Eitz Pri Oseh Peri. You may never become that Eitz Pri, but try. Advance yourself towards that point. You may never reach the finish line, but at least try to address your personal imperfections in some way. You may never fully actualize your full inner greatness, but don't be scared off from doing anything. Don't be scared into submission. Don't become paralyzed into total life inaction. And herein lies the beauty of Tu B'Shvat. When we come to Tu B'Shvat, and you go outside, and the truth is, as I mentioned before, it's more pronounced here in Gullus than it is in Eretz Yisrael, but the truth is, the message is the same. When you go outside and you look at the tree, what do you see? What do you see? You go outside, you're going to look at the tree, what are you going to see? Nothing. You're going to see what would appear to be a lifeless, organic entity. Right? The bark is peeling off, it's not there. The coloring is not there. The leaves have fallen off already. Certainly if it's a fruit tree, it does not have any more fruits on its branches. It looks lifeless. It looks so profoundly deficient and imperfect. But yet, what did the Gemara tell us? That's from the outside. What's happening on the inside? Remember what did Rashi say? What's happened by this time of year already? The majority of the rain has already fallen, and the sap of vitality is surging throughout the tree, yearning, pining to come out. Outside, it looks dead. Outside, it looks lifeless. Outside, it looks like you could just write it off. Call the landscaper and just chop it down because absolutely nothing is going to happen in this tree. But inside is bubbling incredible potential. Inside is bubbling incredible vitality. And therefore, what Chazal tell us, Ki ha'adam eitz hasodeh, go out and look at the tree. And when you look at the tree, what you're really doing is you're looking in the mirror. That tree is me. Because sometimes when I look in the mirror, I feel a little bit lifeless as well. I feel that I'm still struggling with the same things year after year. I still have the same nisyonos, the same trials and tribulations. And even when I try to take one step back, sometimes I end up taking three steps back. I am the same tree that has so much to give, but I'm scared to self-actualize because maybe then the expectations will become too much. And what do Chazal tell us? Go out. Look at the tree. And you know what? The same way that tree, so to speak, is going to partner with God to create something magnificent. Tree partners with God in a very passive way. So too, I have the ability to partner with God in the creative process and to rebuild, rejuvenate, and reinvigorate my tree as well. no matter how lifeless I may look in the present, no matter how imperfect I may look, no matter how much I've handicapped my personal greatness because I'm scared, the sap flows within me as well. You know, the Mefarshim make an amazing observation in the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Bakin number one, if you'll notice, when it talks about all of the Rosh Hashanah, all the New Year's, it phrases it all in the plural, right? Again, if you look, you can look back at it for just a moment. The Mishnah said that there are four Rosh Hashanah, four New Year's. On the first of Nisan is Rosh Hashanah four kings, plural. First of Elul, Maaser Behema, animals, plural. Rosh Hashanah, Shanim, Shmitin, Yovlos, all plural. And yet, when you come to the last line, what does it say? Be'echad B'Shvat, Rosh Hashanah Le'ilon. It is a Rosh Hashanah for the tree and says, V'Arizal, V'Ariyah Kadosh. Why does it say the tree? Why doesn't it say what? Ilonos, plural. It would be perfect sexual symmetry with the Mishnah. Why does it say V'Arizal? Because what Chazal were trying to tell us in a very nuanced fashion is that today, tonight, is the Rosh Hashanah for the tree. And who is the tree? It's you. It's me. It's Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh. Tonight is a brand new beginning. Tonight is a brand new start. Tonight represents when nature, that looks so deficient, looks so imperfect, looks so handicapped, nature, which we know has the potential for such greatness. We saw the trees last year. We saw the fruits. We saw the beautiful leaves. And now it's dead. Well, today is the day that nature begins to regenerate and rejuvenate. And it's the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilon. It's the day that I remind myself that I could regenerate and rejuvenate as well. Today is the day, Tu B'Shvat is the day that I remind myself that I am imperfect and I accept my imperfections. But you better believe that I'm going to rally against them with all of my might. I'm going to try to fix as many as I can. I'm going to try to correct this. I'm going to try to fill in as many voids as I possibly can, recognizing that I will never be an Eitz Pri Yosef Pri, but you better believe that I'm going to try as hard as I can to get there. Today's the day on Tu B'Shvat where I say, you know what? Stop being scared. Stop holding yourself back. We can all do more. We can all be more. We can all accomplish more. And yes, do the expectations go up? Through the roof. But we can meet those expectations. We can live up to those expectations. Those expectations we have of ourselves and the expectations that Kodesh Baruch Hu has of us. That's Tu B'Shvat. And now we understand why this day has such exceptional simcha. Because there is no greater simcha in life than the simcha of a new start, than the simcha, the joy of a new beginning. And this, my friends, is what Tu B'Shvat is for us. Yes, a day that is agriculturally significant, without question. A day, like Rav Moshe said, is where we really begin to own our materialism only because we have used it first to benefit others. But most importantly, a day when we accept our tree identity, Ki Adam Eitz Hasadeh, where we recognize our imperfections and deficiencies, and we recognize that more often than not, the only thing that holds us back in life is ourselves. So let us hope that Emir Tzashem, as we now are in Tu B'Shvat, and over the next day of Tu B'Shvat, hopefully you'll all get your paper bags of fruit Emir Tzashem, or some official, I'm sure, has something much better waiting for you afterwards. But as you eat your fruits of Tu B'Shvat or have your Seder of Tu B'Shvat, in addition to all the beautiful brachos that we make over the different fruits, let us most importantly remember the mindset and the ideology of Tu B'Shvat. Let us all be zocha to embrace our tree identity. Let us be zocha to accept our imperfections, but use every ounce of strength we have to combat them, to compensate for them. Let us embrace our tree identity and recognize that so often we hold ourselves back. Let us recognize that we have the ability to be great. We have the ability to be magnificent if we just stop handicapping ourselves. And let us hope that Emir Tzashem, in the same way that the natural world will very quickly begin to rejuvenate and blossom before our eyes, let us hope that the trees of our personal existence will do the same. Thank you.